by chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Rest make dab in the middle of it. Rest make dab in the middle. We are rest make dab.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. We've got a really fine guest this evening, and his name is Eldon Taylor. And my gosh, he's pioneered in so many areas, and his background is in subliminal programming and so forth. He's considered an expert in the area of preconscious information processing, and has served as an expert trial witness with regard to both subliminal communication and hypnosis. Eldon was a practicing criminologist for over 10 years, where he supervised and conducted investigations and testing to detect deception. His earliest work with changing inner beliefs was conducted from his setting, from this particular setting. Welcome to our program, Eldon Taylor.
It's indeed my pleasure to join you, Mr. George Butler. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, we had a little pre-talk there about you helping the world, and I think you've done a good job at that so far. And you have InnerTalk, that's your founding company, www.innertalk.com. And tell us how you first started in this area. What initiated your and motivated you to get started in doing this and founding this?
Oh, wow. I hope you've got all day for that one. Let me see if I can make a short one.
Sure.
I think some of us are just wired a certain way when we come into the world. I see these young people today, and I watch them with their phones and their computers, and they just somehow intuitively get all this stuff without having to teach it. They must have come in wired. Well, I came in wired, I guess, to wonder why people do what they do. And I guess a long, short story begin like this. I think I was 7, 8 years old when my neighbor lady came over and was visiting with my mother, and she told my mother all the stuff about her husband and how her husband had done these things, and that's why they were getting a divorce. And I listened to her, and I didn't know a lot better, but I knew that she wasn't telling the truth, George. So like a child, I just blurted out, "Why are you lying to my mother?" Well, obviously, I got in a great deal of trouble over that, but it did turn out she was fabricating a lot of information. For some reason, I was always interested in why people told lies, why they compensated in the ways they did. And so the study of psychology and the study of the mind and the study of behavior became a passion with me. Initially, of course, you know, I think it was the philosophies that I really fell in love with, because they tried to explain man's predicament, where we were, what we were here for, why we behaved the way we did, but that was inadequate. And of course, you know, sooner or later, I'm driven into the social sciences and psychology. Well, the long and the short is, years down the road from being 7 or 8 years old, I found myself practicing criminalist. My daily routine consisted of conducting lie detection examinations or a forensic hypnosis session, an interrogation and investigation in the field, something of that nature. And I was constantly coming across people who would confess to a crime that would put them away for a very long time, and they would have the shabbiest of reasons for why they did what they did. You know, usually the reason is designed to get some sympathy from you, to earn some empathy. But let me give you an example. I remember this one very well. I had a really nice-looking, tall young man in my office, had everything going for him in his early 20s, had a good job, was a part-time student at university, was married. His wife was pregnant with their first child. He was living in his in-laws, in a home that his in-laws owned that had been a rental, and they had provided it. And I've got deception charts in front of me indicating that he has stolen lumber from his employer. Now, not a lot of lumber, but it's a felony. I don't recall now. I think it was $1,200, $1,400 worth of lumber. So as I begin to interrogate this young man, he explains to me that his wife is pregnant with their first child, and he's the provider for the family. And as the provider, it's his duty to make sure that they have a proper place for the child, a nursery for the child. And so he took this lumber in order to build a nursery in the basement for the child, something his wife would be proud of. They'd have a nursery, they'd have a bit of a playroom, and he would do this, and it would improve the property for his in-laws. So it was a win-win for everyone, well, except for the employer, who really didn't deserve it because he didn't pay him enough, he didn't pay any of his employees enough, he wasn't a nice guy, da-da-da. So in other words, he'd rationalized all this behavior away, justifying it that the employer deserved to have it taken from him and that his baby deserved to have it done, et cetera, and so forth. You know, you stop and you look at that, and you have to say, this person comes from a good family. He's in the university. He is certainly not stupid. An act like this is driven by what? And then, of course, you come down to the expectations of our society, the expectations of our social roles, and then our ability to manipulate our environment in terms of our perception by placing injustices in some place and justifying actions in another place. Does that make any sense to you, George?
Yeah, the cheating culture seems to come to mind. People can rationalize about anything, can't they?
So, you know, I got myself to this point where it was like, well, what on earth? How do you turn these people around? How do you get them to wake up? I mean, this is just crazy. This guy just ruined his life. He's now a felon. He can't vote. He'll never own a weapon again. He's going away. He's not even going to be there when his baby's born. You know, what a tragedy. Well, at about that time, a friend of mine contacted me because of some work I was doing, George, with subliminal communication in my lie detection practice. And he said, Eldon, I understand that you're able to utilize subliminal to get people to be more honest. And that was basically what we were doing. We were aiming at flushing out, the countermeasures and relaxing those people that come in that have situational stress. He said, do you think we could use this technology that you've developed in the prison system to rehabilitate inmates? Well, I was on the custodial side of that equation, and I have to tell you honestly, George, I didn't have a lot of hope that that was really possible. It seems altogether too often that we warehouse these people and teach them to be better criminals as opposed to rehabilitate. But I said, you know, I don't know. We'll try. We can try that. So we went out to the Utah State Prison, and we conducted the first ever double-blind study of its kind. And, you know, we did some really elaborate psychometrics. We ran the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory, and we used the incarcerated lens, the Fowler lens, and, you know, all this data. And when we were said and done, we didn't get anything we didn't, you know, already know. We had high scores in self and social alienation. But when I met with these inmates, and it was a volunteer group in what's called the Youth Offenders Facility 288, these 30-some-odd young men, they basically shared with me something that was a life-changing moment for me. Because what I heard them say repeatedly was, Abba, for the grace of God, there go you. In other words, look, life sucks and then you die. I mean, my daddy was an alcoholic, my mommy a prostitute, the neighbor boy mainlined me when I was 8 years old. You know, if that had happened to you, what do you think you'd be doing? You know, the bottom line was most of these stories were exaggerated. We could have two brothers that came from the same home, had exactly the same, you know, environment. One would be a physician in a teaching hospital and the other in maximum security in the prison. So it was about their choices. But what they had done, like this young man I told you about with the lumber, what they had done is they had justified their actions. And that was due to the fact that the world owed them something. Society owed them something. Society had done something to them that was unjust, and they had a right to get even. It wasn't their fault. They weren't responsible. They were just doing what the normal person would do. When we got that message, got it clear, I devised a set of affirmations, and we call this subliminal, but it really is, and it's a dichotically mass technology known as inner talk. It's a patented technology, but that's not the point. The point is that you're delivering simultaneous messages to both hemispheres, and the way they're masked, they go unrecognized. We consciously may recognize what we think is a voice is in a distance, but we don't distinguish what's being said. I can explain why that's important later if you want, but what we did then is we created a set of affirmations that was designed to undo the inmate's ability to blame. So as long as he blamed, he was okay. You see, he wasn't responsible. Well, how do you do that? Well, it was this magic set of affirmations that we call today the forgiveness set, and we've used these in everything from the inmate population, hostility, aggression, etc., to sports programs and prosperity programs, and we have found it all very effective in tight double-blind studies conducted by independent researchers, by the way, at leading institutions like Stanford. This isn't just my work. I may create the technology, but other people actually run research. So at any rate, we came up with these three messages. I forgive myself, I forgive all others, I am forgiven. And then we boilerplated that with some positive affirmations about self-esteem, encouraging affirmations about, you know, learning more and enhancing their lives and so forth, okay? That was our interdiction.
Forgiveness is a powerful force there. That's
it. It's incredible. Listen, if you don't forgive, if you're still blaming anybody for anything, you've effectively tied yourself up. I mean, there's two ways to be tied up in the world. Someone can bind you with ropes, George, or you can hang on to a shoestring attached to a doorknob and refuse to pull it hard enough or to let it go. And you're just as tethered there as if you'd been tied like an elephant, you know? And our beliefs our beliefs can do that to us. If we believe that it's righteous, justified to blame, well, that's precisely what we do. We've made ourselves a victim. We have tied ourselves up into that victimhood circularity, and we have thereby limited what we're going to experience in life. At any rate, what we did at the prison system worked. It worked so well. We lowered, were so effective in the data, lowering hostility, aggression, increasing reflectivity, that it was cloned out to a number of other prison systems, and that changed my career. I went from criminalist almost overnight to designing programs that could assist people in all walks of life with all the kinds of objectives that we set out in life that are desirable. Most importantly, about waking up to the unlimited potential within every human being.
Right. Were you influenced by the humanistic psychology movement or the human potential movement in the 60s and 70s or what?
Well, no, I'd have to say no. I mean, you know, it would be nice for me to jump on the bandwagon, but, well, you know, my where I was in the 60s and the 70s was chasing bad guys and locking them away. And my mentality at that point in time certainly was not about, rehabilitation or positive psychology. It was, I tended to be rather jaded. It really was this work at the prison system that was an epiphany to me, because I stood there. See, I could recognize in myself, George, that I had my own blame going on in the world. I had left home really.
Sure, we all have our own struggles, right?
Yeah. Well, you see, and I'd left home really young, and I blamed my dad for this, and I had all this anger and angst, and I found a socially acceptable way to act it out. I could throw the cuffs on somebody and put an extra twist on it. See, and that was acceptable. Well, it really isn't acceptable at all, is it?
You dirty criminal.
You see, when you realize the difference is really a fine line. It's how we act out these feelings. It's the little tint on the perception that we have that often makes the difference between, that super successful person that seems to have the Midas touch, everything they do, relationships, business, everything just works for them, and the poor person that just can't make anything work. And it's just that tint in their perception. It's just in how they see the world, that slight shift that makes that adjustment. And that shift begins with their own inner lens, their own inner belief about who they are. And unfortunately, most of that has been voiced upon them by, their early enculturation, their peers and their parents. And they may have had the best interest in mind, but, you think about how many times you've been told no or don't, you're not smart enough, you're not good-looking enough, you're dumb, you're stupid, you'll never amount to anything. And any and all the negativity that we've experienced in our lives, all of that's recorded in our unconscious, subconscious mind. In fact, George, if I may, something that your listeners really need to be aware of when we talk about the power of the subconscious mind. Right. There are all these books out there, the Joseph Murphys and the Peels and da-da-da-da-da, talk about, the power of the subconscious mind. And I'm not going to subtract from that in what I'm about to say. I'm just going to give you the other side of the coin. The other side of the coin is this, the mind is slayer, the mind is savior. What we know watching the brain lifetime make decisions with functional magnetic resonance imaging, fMRI, is that a MRI technician watching your brain will know what you're going to decide 6 seconds before you do. Pause on that. Wait a minute, I'm going to give you a choice. You're going to have two buttons, one in your right hand, one in your left hand. And depending on which one you push, that's going to determine the choice. I've given you a little bit of a problem. You're viewing it on a screen, and I'm watching your brain, and you're going to make this choice. I see what the brain does. I know what the choice is. I can mark it 6 seconds before you know what you're going to decide. In other words, your subconscious mind is making your decisions. Indeed, the data today shows that 90% of our behavior, our decisions, our actions originate out of a nucleus accumbens, and they are just a matter of automatic. We're on automatic. We're running on what people think of as system one, automatic. The system two, it requires us to think, to weigh the ramifications to our decisions or our choices. To ponder, that's something that we rarely engage in our daily lives. We are on automatic, and so all of this is coming out of our subconscious. And if the repository in our subconscious is full of all this negative, all this doubt, all this fear, all this, programming that we get out of the media today, every single commercial you're ever going to see is designed to tell you one primary thing. You're deficient. Deficient. Because Because if you're not deficient, you don't need what it is that they have for you. You understand that. You know, if you have beautiful, lovely hair, you certainly don't need their shampoo or their dye. You know, if I mean, the bottom line is, if you take all that negativity and you put it in the subconscious, and then you go out into the world and you say something positive like, I'm a good person. I'm going to be successful. I'm just going to make $1 million this year for the heck of it. What's going to come back out of your subconscious is going to be a stream of self-talk that goes something like, you know, good at what? Who are you kidding? What are you going to do, rob a bank? You know, it actually is not going to be in agreement with what you're consciously saying. And that's what moves us through our lives.
Right, right. You know this know thyself goes way back, doesn't it, in time?
Yeah.
Saying, I mean, people don't know themselves, do they? It's hard to get to know, to wake up, you know? Part of your work then is to awaken people to the way they really are, right?
It is. You know, George,
so
what am
they
I...
They don't see it. They're programmed into acting and reacting so much that they don't look at themselves, you know, their own, frailties and weaknesses.
You have that perfectly said. I mean, the bottom line comes down to this. Choice, for most people, is an illusion. Now, think about that for a second.
Yeah.
Krishnamurti said choice is an illusion because if I know with certainty there is no choice, you know, I just do it. I only choose when I'm confused. But let me flesh that out a little more in concert with what you just said. I'll share a little story with you. One of my favorites that illustrates how we operate in the world with regard to understanding ourselves and with regard to how our unconscious drives our actions. So imagine that you're in New York. It's first time to the big city. You've always wanted to go to the Big Apple. You've heard all kinds of things about it. You've seen pictures. You know, your trip has been arranged, and you arrive, and it's a glorious, glorious morning. Unbelievable. Like, you know, one of a kind. It's just perfect weather. And you decide to take a walk. And as you're walking through the city, and, you know, you kind of wander out a little bit, and you find yourself into this high-rise condominium area. And it's, the grounds are perfectly manicured. It's beautiful high-rise buildings, condos that cost $1 million a copy, you know, to begin. And you're just wowed by it all. It's just gorgeous. And as you walk,
right,
a flower pot falls from the third-story balcony and strikes you on the head. It breaks, the chars fall to the sidewalk and out into the street, and now you have a choice. You stand there. You know you're all right. You got a throbbing going on your head. You're going to have a bump, abrasion, and,
right,
you know, what is this about? Now, I'm going to tell you that there are three decisions almost everybody comes to. The first choice is, I'm going to grab the charge of this pot, take them upstairs, and put them you know where.
Right, right.
Of course, if I knock on the door and I find it, the owner of that condo is a lineman for the New York Giants, I might change my mind.
Right, you get out of there.
Okay.
Fast.
The second choice, you know, I'm going to sue this fat cat. You know, this could be whiplash. That was crazy. I mean, that shouldn't have happened. I'm going to sue them. This will be an easy case. They'll settle it out of court. The third choice, I'm going to be metaphysical. This is such a beautiful morning. That flower pot, I mean, you know, it hit me on the head, but I'm not going to let it ruin my day because, I mean, after all, it may have, that blow may have somehow enlightened me, turned on new neurons, and I will become more enlightened as a result. I think of that,
right,
by the way, as a form of denial, you know.
Right.
But okay, those are the three choices.
Okay.
What else could you do? I've asked this question by now of tens of thousands of people, And there's always this long pause. Like, well, I don't know. What else can you do? How about I just pick up the flower and, you know, gather a little soil with it, take it to the florist and have it repotted? I mean, why should it die? Hey, you know what I would do, George? I would take it back to that third-story balcony owner, knock on his door. Hey, your flower pot fell off the balcony. You hit me on the head. Kind of hurts. I want you to know that. But I don't want the flower to die, so I repotted it. How do you like the pot? Imagine the look on the person's face. Now, when you put your head on the pillow at night, because I'm a pragmatist, what works, okay? When you put your head on the pillow at night, of all those scenarios, which one's going to make you feel the best? Where's the smile going to come from?
Right.
Think about that. So what we do, we get ourselves so programmed that we think, yeah, I got A, B, and C, kind of like the multiple choice questions that we get in school.
Right.
And we don't think that, you know, there's a whole alphabet that goes clear to Z. We don't stop to look at all the other possibilities that exist in everything in our life. And to that extent, we're really alienated from ourselves, you know. I mean, truly alienated. One of my very favorite books of all time. In fact, my son said to me not long ago, Dad, of all the books you've ever read in your life, and I have volumes in my library, what is the most important? And I told him, it's The Politics of Experience by R.D. Lang. Lang says this: the condition of alienation, of being asleep, of being unconscious, of being out of one's mind, is the condition of the normal man. Society highly values its normal man. It educates children to lose themselves and to become absurd, and thus to be normal. We are not able even to think adequately about the behavior that is at the annihilating edge. But what we think is less than what we know. What we know is less than what we love. What we love is so much less than what there is, and to that precise extent, we are so much less than what we are.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. There's an author that we've interviewed before, and he says something about we're not aware of how unaware we are.
No, that's true. That's very true. We, for all intent and purposes, like I say, we go through the world, you know, unconscious, and we have this whole set of life beliefs. Now, I'm not talking about spiritual beliefs when I say that. People think spirituality as soon as you say beliefs. But I'm talking about life beliefs, okay? Look, we run studies. Let's take placebos for a moment, okay?
Okay.
We look at a placebo, and when I went to university, you know, a placebo was good for 20-25%, okay? That was kind of the standard number, but that's just a plain white pill. All the research now shows us, look, if we take that plain white pill, we make it a little bit larger and put a nice big initial on it, well, it's more powerful. If we put it in a capsule, it's still more powerful. But, hey, if we colorize it and we even know what colors work best, then it's more powerful yet. Oh, right. But you know, if we make it an injection, it's still even more powerful. What's going on here? Why are we able to work this placebo up to where we might get 75% cure rates, as high as the pharmaceutical itself? It's your belief. It's your expectation. What is it you're saying? Well, every time, every single time we change this, what's changed is the value, the perception that you have. Well, you know, look, that colored capsule's got to be more than that plain white pill cost. And that injection is certainly a lot more than, you see. And this belief is so powerful. David Phillips at UC San Diego said, in what I consider to be a seminal study of its kind, if belief is this important, I should be able to go to China and look at their historical records and find a correspondence between what people died of and what their horoscopes said they would die of. Because in the Chinese horoscope system, and they invest a lot of belief in it, you not only learn what your avocations and vocations and talents might be, but what you're going to die of. So, you know, you're born under the sign of the horse. Maybe that means you die of cancer. You're born under the sign of the rooster. Maybe that means you go in your sleep, irregardless of your behavior, okay? What he found when he looked at the historical data was, I mean, just robust support for the notion that, in fact, if you believed you would die of cancer, it didn't matter what you did, you died of cancer. If you believed that you would go in your sleep at a ripe old age, it didn't matter how much you smoked, drank, etc., that's what you died of, how you died, when you died. That's an incredible revealing study. Belief itself, our life beliefs, they have more power than we tend to give them credit for. And they exist in a web. This, you know, there's no such thing as a standalone belief. They're all tied out here in this web, and most of them we're completely ignorant of. So Susan Boyle, UK's Got Talent, the singer, do you remember her?
Yeah.
This disheveled, you know, homemaker walks on the stage, circa 50s, you know, house dress. I mean, hair is, get out of here. I mean, they stopped teasing hair in the late 50s or 60s, I think, all teased out, you know, and everybody laughs. The audience is roaring. The judges, their eyes are rolling, you know. What do we got here, you know? And the woman opens her mouth, and the most mellifluous sound comes out. And we should pause. What makes us think a singer should look a certain way? She didn't come out here as a beauty contestant or a fashion model. She came out here as a singer. So, you know, hey, how does what she wears or does her hair, how is that going to impact how she sings? But we have all these shortcuts to how we think and how we reason. And so we say to ourselves, you know, well, she can't be a singer because our expectation, our mind tells us singers look a certain way. We've seen them on TV. We see them in the movies. There's no way this is a singer. Well, that's nonsense, isn't it? You know, one of my favorite samples of how we just, you know, our thinking confuses us. I want you to think about a glass, if you will, just a little shot glass, George. Now, I'm not gonna assume that you've ever, you know, had anything hard to drink in your life. So, you know, you've seen one on TV anyway, haven't you?
Those little shot
glasses. Okay, all right, George. So you and I both got a shot glass. I've got mine in front of me. You've got yours in front of you. Let's have our audience all imagine they've got theirs. Okay. Now, I want you to think about the saliva in your mouth. I'm going to ask you to grade the saliva because, as far as I'm concerned, I get my saliva at 10. If I don't have saliva in my mouth, I can't talk to you. And I've had dry mouths, and they're horrible. So I want you to grade the saliva in your mouth. On a scale from 1 to 10, what do you give it? I mean, 1 being it's horrible, distasteful, rotten, should have brushed my teeth 6 months ago. 10 being, I'm really glad I've got it, and I enjoy it, you know? All right, you got it graded?
Yeah.
Okay, now what I want you to do is imagine that you're depositing some of it in that shot glass, okay? Just deposit some of that saliva in the shot glass. Maybe you tip it a little, you know, look at it. All right, now, knock it on back, drink it. See what happens. The minute you do that, people... Saliva in my mouth is fine, but spit in a glass, get out of my face. I'm not drinking spit in a glass. You know, I do this little exercise. Hundreds of people, how can you ask us to drink spit?
Right.
The context gets confused. The saliva in my mouth is just great, but the minute it's in that glass, that context has completely changed it. And so... you know, wait a minute, hold it. I push it away. I'm not drinking spit. So, George, this evening I come to your door and I knock on your door, you know, your 4x8 wood door, and I say, hey, I need a 4x8 piece of wood to win this contest I'm in, and if you've got one, I'll split the $10,000 prize with you. Odds are you're going to say, I don't have a wood pile, I don't need a 4x8 piece of wood, and you're going to close your 4x8 wood door. Because you don't see it as being what it is. you see it for what you've defined it to be. And we go through life largely that way. You know, we operate basically on definitions, and the definitions tell us what things are. So we may not know what they are. Scientists are still debating exactly what electricity is. But I throw the switch on and the lights go on and I say, yeah, it's electricity, I know what that is, and I get on with my life without going any further. There's a wonderful verse in the Tao Te Ching, it's the 11th verse. It talks about 30 spokes. It essentially says there are 30 spokes that converge upon a single hub. Now, think about this for a minute. One of these old wagon wheels. And you're going to describe the wagon wheel. So it's got 30 spokes, it's got a hub, it's maybe got a metal band around the outside, wood frame, and, you know, it's certain size. That's how you're going to describe that wood wheel. Is that right?
Right.
What
right.
you're not going to do is describe what makes it useful. The hole.
I see.
The hole in the hub. You see, without that hole in the hub, it's not useful. So when people talk about things, we tend to, you know, a flower pot. Yeah, I bought my wife a new flower pot. Well, what's it like? We think about the flower pot, you know, it's made of alabaster or clay, and it's so high and a certain color. We don't think about the fact that what makes the flower pot, usable is the fact that it has a cavity in it, nothing. A hole is nothing.
Right.
Very often it's the nothing in the world that is the most important thing, and we fail to see it.
Yeah. That's when the mind can go into a rest state and be curative, can it not?
It can. It can. That's true.
See?
You know, meditation is a marvelous you know, means today. I can tell a little story on myself if you don't mind. I started to meditate in this whole wake up process, this going way back the end of the 70s into the very early 80s. And but you know, on a daily basis, I met a friend of mine who happened to be chief of police in a small community, and so this given day, his name was Dwayne. Dwayne calls my home, and my housekeeper answers, and Dwayne says, hey, is Eldon there? I want to move our evening coffee off a little. And she says, no, I'm sorry, he's meditating. He's what? He's meditating. Well, back then, meditation was something they did in the Far East where they, you know, don't eat cows and do other
backward people did.
And this is a police chief who, you know, I mean, he served in Vietnam, shot down twice in copters, you know, I mean, a real man's man, gung-ho, and he is roaring. He is, well, I can't tell you the amount of ridicule that I had to bear from my friends, thanks to him, sharing it with everybody, you know, while we sat around and had evening coffee, okay?
Right.
Today, however, meditation is mainstay. You see your cardiac care provider, he tells you to start meditating. You see your coach, your personal coach, they tell you to start meditating. Mindfulness has been shown to really make all kinds of changes in the human condition that are beneficial. One simple 12-minute meditation, a study demonstrated that meditation, when carried out for just 30 days, 12 minutes for just 30 days, actually increased cognitive abilities. We had some gray matter change, increase in gray matter. You know, I was recently at a CEU course that was sponsored by the Institute for Brain Potential, and there were two takeaway points that were emphasized that are appropriate for me to add, I think, at this juncture, George. Dr. Kateri McRae, a neurologist, neuroscientist, was the presenter, and those two points, you know, essentially came down to this. You can change many things: your personality, your IQ, your habits, and even physical aspects of your brain, including the organization by which you utilize or process information. You can increase gray matter and more. That's point number one. That's pretty exciting, because this is not, you know, new age foo-foo. This is neuroscience, okay? The second one, though, and of utmost importance, you can only change what you believe you can change. Let me say it again, neuroscience. Again, not mumbo-jumbo lingo. Hard science based on actual observation says you can only change what you believe you can change. So for all of your listeners, you know, and anyone that might come onto your program at any time, the bottom line to all of this comes down to, if you've got self-limiting life beliefs, if you're in one of those places where your view on the world is life sucks and then you die, thank God it's Friday, I can't wait to get away from my job, on and on and on. That's a belief system that you are buying into. You don't have to buy into it. Where it came from is of no matter. Using simple mindfulness techniques, reflecting on the thoughts, that stream of consciousness that comes in, meditating, or using technology like the InnerTalk programs we talked about earlier, self-hypnosis, doing these kinds of things, you can take this subterranean material that's in your subconscious and raise it up to where you see it for what it is, and it loses its power, rewriting at the same time in your subconscious that kind of belief system that empowers your goals in life. Let me make a point clear here, just so I'm sure we understand.
Sure,
when we're a child, perhaps we have a bad dream, or better still, let's take a different look at this. I'm in my bedroom, it's dark, the lights are out, I'm having trouble falling asleep, I roll over and I look in the corner, holy cow, there's a boogeyman in the corner. I can see him. I see him over there. I think every child has experienced seeing something in the room that looked like it was evil intruder. Okay, I yell out. Mom and Dad come to the door. They throw the door open and turn the light on. And you know what? I see it's how I hung my clothes over the closet door. Okay?
Yep.
They laugh at me. I laugh with them. They turn the light out, close the door. I look right at the boogeyman, but it's my clothes hanging on the closet door. That boogeyman no longer has power over me. And that's what happens when we flush these beliefs, moving them up to where we see them as the self-limiting, or where they came from and how they have controlled us. You know, a fellow once I spoke to said to me, you know, I've got a problem, and I really, you know, I don't know what to do about it. My wife's ready to leave me. I don't have many friends anymore, but I just came to understand that they think I'm a stoic. They think that I could dampen the most lively of power parties if I were just in the room. And I don't know why, because I mean, I hear them tell jokes and they're funny and so forth. Well, in talking, it turned out that this young man, when he was very young, like 8, 9, 10 years old, was with a group of friends, and something funny happened, and he took off laughing. And because of the way he laughed, one side of his mouth raised higher than the other, and they made fun of him. And so the laugh began a laugh at him. He felt ridiculed, humiliated, disgraced. Subconscious mind made a decision. The mechanism we call defense mechanisms kicked in. Didn't laugh again. Wasn't going to be ridiculed or criticized like that. No laughter came out of him. Once he recognized that that's what happened, that boogeyman in the corner was seen for what it was. He could go back to being his natural self, laughing, enjoying himself, and he did, and it fixed his life. And that's what I mean about these life beliefs that we have that are in this web that's all tied together, that it's so important for us to come to understand, to wake up to, in order to live into our true potential.
Yeah, these are predispositions that are ingrained in ourselves. Could there be something that it begins at childbirth and there's a splitting off maybe occurs from the core real self of a false self or an ego self, maybe, and then the parents are nurturing that ego false self?
Well, the bottom line to that is yes. There's all kinds of theories regarding it. But,
sure.
If you're raised in a chicken yard, you come to believe you're a chicken.
Right.
We know the imprinting process is such that we can take ducklings and we can put them in a chicken yard, and pretty quick they're scratching and trying to behave just like chickens. They'll even drown when you put them in water. So, the fact of the matter is, everything that we're impressed with in our environment, in our socialization during maturation, has a mark on us. And, they take an elephant when it's very, very young, and they'll tie it with a very large chain. And the elephant will run towards its mom, hit the end of that chain, bang, down it goes. Back up, run again, bang, down it goes. It learns the length of that chain. And pretty quick, it only walks out to the end. It doesn't challenge it. And then as an adult, you can tie it with the smallest of ropes, and it will not challenge it because it has learned its limitation. Unfortunately, many of us have been raised in a way, trained in a way, brainwashed, if you will, in a way, where a limitation has been placed on us and we bought it. Susie says, well, I'm just not good at math. John says, I don't get English, We have, and those are just trite little examples. We have
Are these parental influences then? So we're captured by those parental influences at an early age.
True, and it isn't just parental, though. Same. I mean, we have to expand it to our society. My latest book, Gotcha, The Subordination of Free Will, is all about how society voiced this on us. I mean, our education system, admittedly, is not about teaching you. It's about socializing you, period, end of quotation.
Exactly.
John Dewey, Edward Thorndike brought this three-tiered Prussian system from 1819 to America to socialize us. Edward Bernays, the father of propaganda, worked with the presidents in many, many corporations, creating today what has become to be, a level of marketing. We don't think of scientific marketing anymore. We call it neuromarketing. We actually watch the brain lifetime while we stimulate it. Okay?
Well, we raise a bunch of hustlers coming out of our universities in marketing, right? They become hustlers instead of marketing people.
That's right. That's exactly right. Yeah. So,
They become, they're using all mind wash and programs. And how about neuro-linguistic program? Are they using that too?
Well, yes. Listen, you're going to use NLP in an interrogation scenario quite often.
Sure.
You're going to use it.
Okay.
If you're a politician, you're going to see it all the time. And listen, when a politician steps to a stage, the stage will be elevated. That causes your eyes to lift up, doesn't it? No, my eyes lift up. I want that to happen. That's both a hypnotic form of induction as well as an NLP modem, okay? And then I'm going to speak at a very derived cadence, okay? That's going to be very important. I'm going to have that color and that sound effects behind me, and for all intent and purposes, I'm going to do everything I can to get you personally involved, following my postures, my gestures, NLP, to where you enter a twilight state that isn't any different than that slowed alpha brainwave state that you're in hypnosis. That wide-eyed form of hypnosis is accomplished on a quite regular basis. I forgive me, but I don't think there was anybody, any politician, ever better at it than Barack Obama.
Well, a friend of mine attended a fundraiser here in Austin of the president's, and the people paid $30,000 to attend, and he used NLP the whole time on them.
Yeah, well,
and a friend of mine is an expert in NLP, and he didn't record it, but he was there to witness the mechanisms and the techniques of NLP on the crowd that paid $30,000 to be there.
Yeah, well, listen, Obama is a very intelligent person.
Yes, he is.
He hired the elite, what we think of as the elite of elite social psychologists during his last campaign to orchestrate every aspect of it. So whether it was a Cialdini, the father of compliance principle, I mean, these were the best of the best of the guys that do all the research to determine all the little things that cause you to do. Listen, and they are subtle. I'll just give you a quick one because I know we're short of time. But if I give you a survey, and that survey is designed to determine whether you're liberal or you're conservative, if I put a jar of hand sanitizer on the table, it will skew your answers to conservative. Why? Well, think about it. Jar of hand sanitizer says, danger, watch out, germs, disease, da-da-da. Little crimes of that nature to outright manipulation of the Internet in terms of how many people have searched this, what are the highest ratings, who approves, all of that used today to form opinion. And the solid research behind it, conducted by these guys that are the social psychologists that form, well, not all of them, I wasn't there, but that formed the team, that's the elite team Barack Obama used. That make sense to you?
Well, you know, I went back to the Fabian Society in the 1800s in England.
Uh-huh.
And it seemed to me that the movement is to create a collective political state, and you can easily more manipulate people through entitlement programs and benefits, see? And that's where I see the world headed right now.
Amen.
From the Fabian Society onward, see? And in other words, you're talking about empowering individuals with your work. That's what I see what you're saying. And these other people out here are using others, you know what I mean?
To manipulate
through a collective group, community, see? Communitarianism would be an example, see?
I think very largely of what we do is an antidote. It's an antidote to what you're talking about. And you're right.
Exactly.
You're absolutely right,
George. I see this as breaking that predisposed programming talk that was induced into us by whoever, and then overcoming that, but standing outside of the mind and looking back at the mind as it's real-time thinking and seeing what those thoughts, how they control and enslave us. See what I mean?
You got it.
And your 100%. Work is waking up people on a multiple level of different ideas and so forth to realize what they are and who they are and how they're enslaving themselves.
That's the aim, and that is the desire, and so we continue to work there because I have an absolute confidence that the human condition hasn't a clue about how high up is yet. There is so much potential in this world that if we just would, each of us, come to grasp with what's really going on, and become more awake about who we are and what that potential is, we'd have a better world overnight.
Yes, yes. I put three things together one time, and one was know thyself, and I added know thy thoughts and know thy world to that basic saying.
You got it.
And so know,
And then the world, well, Krishnamurti, in his dissolution speech, they gave me permission to put that in my last book, by the way, okay? His dissolution speech in the Netherlands there, where he dissolved the whole organization that he was head of. See?
Yeah, right.
And he told them why. He told them in detail why he was disbanding and the whole organization that he headed up. So there's a lot to this in there. And you've really done a great deal of work, and it's really enlightening. And do you have any closing statements? We have about 3 minutes and a half to go here.
Well,
do you have anything else that you can think of that you wanted to close on?
Sure. You know, absolutely. I mean, you kind of cued me there. We have the famous, above all else, know thyself. But we,
right.
You know, we also have Socrates. And it was Socrates
yes.
who said, the unexamined life is not worth living. So
yes,
get down, the bottom line comes down to this. Why does all of this conversation matter? Well, because I will not let anyone walk through my mind with their dirty feet, and neither should you.
Hey, I like that. I like that, Eldon. They don't let anyone wipe their feet on your mind. Right?
That's right.
as a doormat, you know.
That's right.
But I'll tell you, you have some very, very interesting things to say, and you've done so much. You've written, I see, 4 books here. And what is your site again? It's at innertalk.com. Is that right?
Well, yes, you can go to Innertalk, INNERTALK.com, for the technology we were talking about earlier, that dichotic subliminal. Or you can just go to my personal website, which is Eldon, E-L-D-O-N, Taylor, T-A-Y-L-O-R, EldonTaylor.com. There you can learn about my radio show
also.
And pardon?
Yeah, you have a co-host on your Provocative Enlightenment program. Tell us just a second about that.
Yeah, well, Provocative Enlightenment is kind of a passion for me, because what I wanted to do, George, I had this imaginary event as a child that I decided I was going to act out as part of my bucket list. And that imaginary event was, imagine this large round table, and around it seated are all the great minds. And so I want, Schrodinger there, and I want Einstein there, and I want Socrates and Plato and Aristotle, and, I want Einstein, and I want Gandhi, and I want Martin Luther King. You know, I'm going to get all these great minds there, and I'm going to ask them questions. So what I did with Provocative Enlightenment was decide, the way to do this now is through radio. I'm going to bring these great minds to my show.
Okay.
And we're going to uncover how they think, And that's what we do. And it is a fun show. And my co-host is my lovely bride, Ravinder, and we have a lot of fun there. And I invite everybody to join us. Go to EldonTaylor.com, and you can learn all about the show. I'm sorry,
okay,
George.
Well, we want to thank you, Eldon Taylor, for being with us this evening. We have up all those click-offs and directing people to you, and we certainly appreciate your time and all your hard work and your contributions to helping people.
It's indeed been my pleasure, and you keep up doing the great work you're doing, Mr. Butler, sir.
Well, a little bit, but not like you. Okay, we thank you a lot. Okay, good night. Bye-bye.